several of you, I should say, were in the forces, so I'm sure some of the things I tell you about will amuse you and remind you. Some of the things you may say to me, absolute nonsense. So don't hesitate to sort of butt in or join in or say whatever you like. I have to tell you, my dears, I didn't rush to join the forces the day war broke out, because I'm doing a job I like very much, and we lived in London, and of course there was this sort of feeling, oh, it will be over by Christmas, and of course it wasn't over by Christmas, and the phony war, if you remember, went on for literally for months.
Well,
it was over a year, wasn't it? Because when it got to the, I always remember that first big air raid in September of 1940 in the Saturday afternoon, watching the, as the light went out of the ordinary light of the sky, it all lit up with the fires in the east end of London. We were living in St. John's Wood then, and my two sisters were away. Anne was nursing, and Mary Rose's school had been evacuated. My brother was reading medicine at Barts, and I was at home, of course, and my younger brother was still at school. The daylight raids were rather alarming because we all went off to different parts of London. Father went to what he called the works, which was Harvey Street. He was a consultant ophthalmic surgeon. I went to the West End. My young brother went out to the southeast of London. Mother and her faithful maid Claire were stuck in St. John's Wood, and we often wonder whether we'd all meet again in the evening. Anyway, the time came when I felt, though my firm were very anxious for me to stay on with them, because by then I was doing the stock taking and the accounts and the travelling, as well as modelling the clothes, but I felt I would have probably been called up if I hadn't volunteered. So I thought to myself, I'd rather like the idea of joining the Wrens. So when I applied, they said they only had vacancies for bat women. But as I could barely knew how to clean my own shoes, let alone anybody else's, I thought, well, I don't think that's quite me. And I didn't like the colour of the ATS uniform. So I thought I'd join the WEFs. It's more becoming, I felt. So my school friend and I, she'd been doing packing parcels for prisoners of war, and I'd been doing farm watching, that sort of thing. Obviously, one did that. And we trotted along to the Air Force headquarters in Kingsway to join up, and they were welcomed us with open arms and said, oh yes, of course, you'll be together during your training and possibly when you're posted and so on. But that didn't happen, because you see, my father had been born in Dunas Aries in 1866 at the Estancia. And that seemed to cause great alarm and despondency. I think they thought it was some sort of a spy. So you see, Audrey's call-up came, but not mine. Anyway, I hung about, and finally I was called up, and that was, by then, it was the late autumn of 1941. And the first thing we had to do was to go to a big camp called Innsworth, which was between Gloucester and Cheltenham. And there we all were, piling onto the train in our silly clothes and hats and, you know, not a lot of luggage you were allowed to take. And we arrived at this great big camp where they were training recruits. We were put into a hut for about 30 people. I have to tell you, before I actually got my call up, I had a great piece of luck, because I got to know a very nice WEF who was getting on the bus with me every morning to go into town. She was working at Baker Street, and she said, you know, I approached her and said, I'm going into the West quite soon. She said, I'll give you a few tips what to take. She said, get yourself a baby pillow, because she said the pillows aren't really pillows, they're bolsters, sort of stuffed with straw. She said, you'll be very popular if you get an electric iron with a bayonet plug that you can plug into the light. Do you remember the things we hung off the light? And she said, an alarm clock, and of course a hot water bottle, she said. So I'd equip myself with all these things, and I was quite popular in our hut. And I always remember that first night, there we all were, undressing, getting into our various nightgowns, pyjamas, and, you know, even their dressing gowns, realising that the ablutions were you know, miles from the hut, but you had to put a coat on if you wanted to go to the loo or anything and wash. And of course, a lot of these girls had never been away from home before. I had been at boarding school, so I had great home life, and so I was terribly homesick. I'll never forget that first night. I thought, what have I done? I'm here, there's nothing I can do, I can't get out of this. And I may say there were a few muffled sobs that night. And of course, some of these girls, not only had they never been away from home, I discovered as time went on, they're extremely innocent and naive. I remember one girl saying to me, "You can't have a baby the first time you do it, can you?" I said, "Oh, you can." I said, "Just keep your legs crossed." Which was our sort of joke, wasn't it? Anyway, and then we all looked rather amusing in our various clothes, night clothes. I think we looked even funnier later, because Rosemary remember when the pyjamas were issued. And striped, blue and white striped flannel pyjamas that we all passed about them. But they were very practical, you see, and quite warm. And of course, you had to put your greatcoat on to go to the ablution because it was so cold. Anyway, going back to that first days of training, of course, as you had a lot to do in the first few days, which helped take your mind off homesickness, we were issued with our uniforms, we had medicals. One of the horrors for me was the shoes. You see, my feet then, they're still in there now, but I was a triple A whip. And of course, they issue with these great big black boots. But my poor feet, I had to break my feet in, you know, not the shoes. And of course, our uniforms and the bloomers that we called blackouts. And shirts and hats. Because the great coats were very practical because they were very warm. They had this double fastening across. And the top part was lined with sort of white flannel, which made it warmer, but a terrible struggle to get into if you had a uniform jacket on. And there was always the rule, spring and summer, either great coats would be worn or great coats wouldn't be worn. And once that date was decided, it didn't matter what the weather was like. You couldn't suddenly decide it's cold today, I'm going to wear my great coat. If it was a cold spring, it just wasn't allowed. There were no raincoats, but there were, I think, ground sheets, literally were ground sheets, that we wrapped round like a cape, and they were with sort of buttons, well, not really buttons, but copper things that held them over you, and there were gas capes that had to be rolled up very, very small to fit into your gas mask case, because it was the services gas mask, not like the ones that we carried about in the caramel boxes. Of course, the gas mask case were quite handy to put your makeup in, you know, you weren't allowed to carry handbags or anything like that. Of course, the main thing was, how do you move a great body of women or men about? You have to have them in a squad. So we were in lines of three abreast and a squad of 30. Of course, a lot of them hardly knew their left feet from their right, but they had to be taught how to march and halt and all these orders to move them about the camp. And of course, that came even more important when we were moved on after a few days to Morecambe. Morecambe, you probably know, the seaside town in Lancashire, and that was, can you believe it, the town, almost like having Cleveland as a training town, the town was the camp. There wasn't camp with huts or things, we were all in village. And before we left Gloucester, they explained to us that we would be split up, you know, into smaller villages, there were little bed and breakfast houses we were put into. And they said that the billets for the recruits, if we found that they were unsuitable or dirty or anything, we, you know, were allowed to complain. Fortunately, I made friends with one of the girls. I hadn't gone with anyone I knew, but her surname began with A and mine with B, and we sort of always seemed to be next to each other, so that we piled up together. Her name was Mary Ayres, and she and I were put into the same billet at Morecambe. And it was dirty, and the sheets hadn't been changed since the last girls were there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we staggered on parade the next morning with our kit bags to say, we can't stay in this village. And they said, sorry, you've got to go back there. They're very short of billets. So we had to go back there for the 2 weeks. We weren't the most popular people. You can imagine the people who owned the house. I think they'd changed the sheets. And then we had this extraordinary performance of being marched all over Morecambe. Definitely necessary to move them about in squads, you see. You couldn't have skeletons wandering about. And we had lectures in Baptist halls, in little theatres. We had PT, and I think that was at the end of the pier in the ballroom there. You know, all over the town were these girls marching about, being given these different talks. You see, you also had to realize that this was an entirely different life from civilian life. They had to be instilled into them that you were in the services, that you took a pride in the services, you were given a certain amount of history about the RAF, and that you had to learn to live together, hygiene lectures, all sorts of things. And during that time, you gradually sort of bonded into what you were planning to do for the services. But of course, at the end of the time, there came the postings, which were all very exciting. I had gone in as a trade of admin on the advice of the girl I met before I joined. And Mary and I and all the others were in the biggest theatre in Morecambe waiting to hear where we were to be posted. And we got to our names. Where do you think we were posted to? Morecambe. The total horror. And I remember as we went out of the hall, the sergeant, we had a sergeant who was, oh, she was a real bossy boots. Her name was Sergeant Boss. I think she'd been a barmaid and was used to calling out, "Time, gentlemen, please." A great big giant blonde. And she said, "Now, Burton, you can call spot the halls and then dismiss them, if that's what you're going to be doing." But of course, for the first few weeks, we had to go around with the sergeant to find out how to do all this, you know, to tell them to halt on the proper foot and all that sort of thing. And our billets were moved, and Mary and I, fortunately together, we were put into a little back street, a little three-bedroom house run by a funny little woman called Mrs. Birch, who had two little girls. She and the two little girls slept in their sitting room. We had what she would call the front room as our living room. There were four wraps in the house. Mary and myself shared a room, and two girls who were general duties. And there was even another woman in the house who had Mrs. Birch's bedroom and worked in a bank. So we were quite a crowd. The food was disgusting. We were only allowed to have a bath once a week. So that Mary and I shared each other's bathrooms, if you know what I mean. We got into the bath after the other one got out. And then we found out that one of the hotels that was still sort of open for civilian trade, we could, for 2 shillings, we could have a bath in one of their bathrooms. So that was a lovely way to spend the evening, you know, having a lovely hot bath and a nice tile bath and a bare towels and things. And so we learned how to train these recruits. And because the first group I had was really pretty terrifying. They were cooks and butchers. I'm not being snobbish, but they were mostly conscripts too. And of course I realized I didn't know how I was going to control this 30 girls, you know, moving them all around Morecambe. So in the end, I worked out a scheme, and as soon as I got my intake, as we call them, I marched these girls down to a side street, and I said to them, "Now look, we have got to live together for the next 2 weeks, and I can make it quite pleasant for you if you will behave and do what I say. If you don't," I couldn't really think to mind you, but I threatened them, "if you don't," I said, "I can make life very difficult for you." And somehow that worked. And when I took them to have their injections and vaccinations, because the great thing was, if one failed, they all went down like 90. So as I lined them up outside, I said, "Now, I've had all this. It's only injection and vaccination, and you have a couple of days off at your billets. I said, if one of you faints, if only one faints, I will not go to headquarters and pick up your mail. I will not come and visit you at your billets. But if you all stay upright, of course I'll do everything I can and come and see you every day and check it." None of my girls ever fainted. I was such a bully, yet at the end of one of the training sessions, they came on duty, and they were in ground sheets, I remember, and I said, "What on earth have you got under your ground sheet, Fish?" I said to this girl, whose name was Fish. He showed this great bulge, and it was a box, I think they called it a coffret, a present for me. It was talcum powder and soap, all to match, and they clubbed together to buy it for me as a present. I felt dreadful.
because I've been to all of them. I thought, but anyway, they seem to like it. But one of the, I did get a few perks in a way, because as you can imagine, with a railway station in the middle of the town, if anybody wanted to run away, there's nothing to stop them slipping onto a train. And of course, they'd get picked up when they got to wherever they were going as they came out because they had another pass. And occasionally I got the chance of going to London to bring a prisoner back, because the sergeant would go, and they have to have a ranker with them to sort of deal with the girl, because if the girl starts hitting the sergeant, it would be extra on the charge, you see. And in fact, when they used to come up before the officer on the charge, they always had their hats taken away from them in case they threw it at the officer. And I remember one particular girl we fetched from London. You see, I could have a night at home, save the Air Force paying for me to be in a hospital. And then I would meet the sergeant the next day at the police station or whatever and pick up the girl. And we had this long journey, it was at least 6 hours on the train. And this particular girl was a real cockney sparrow, full of fun and life, and she said, not going to be stuck in here for long anyway. She said, I'm pregnant. And, so we had a pleasant time on the train, which was late, and when we got in, the sergeant said, oh, you'll be too late to get this girl back to her village to get a meal, so, you know, here's a voucher to take her to the fish and chip shop, which I did, and the girl said to me, haven't you got a voucher, Admin? And I said, no, I haven't, and she said, never mind, you're our true children. And she just the wallet, you're stuffed with money. And I remember seeing her scrubbing floors, you know, during the next week or two, we waved, and she soon got out, because if you're pregnant, you could get out. And there was another occasion when I was sent for to go and keep a girl awake who had taken an overdose of aspirin. She was in the hospital, and we had to keep feeding her water to make her sick and walking her up and down. And you kept her alive that night. And I felt quite pleased about that, because a week or so later, I had to go to her village or something like that. It wasn't one of my girls, but I knew where she lived, and I could see this pretty animated girl chattering away with the others, and I thought, I was so pleased, you know, that she didn't succeed, probably in homesickness or, you know, boyfriend trouble or something like that. Anyway, that was the way life went on all through the winter in Morecambe. It was a town of women. There were no men about, you know, the social life. I think there were a few army cadets one used to see occasionally. But it was very dreary from that point of view. But there were all kind people. Do you remember in the forces, there were people that would ask you out who were total strangers, but being put in touch with you by other friends or your family or somebody in London who knew somebody who lived somewhere. And of course, they would ask you out. It was lovely to go to somebody's house and sit in a comfortable chair, have tea out of a teacup with a saucer. I always hated mugs ever since the war, because when we were in camp, we had to carry around with us a mug and a spoon, knife, spoon and fork all the time. And anyway, another thing we did was we often used to nip out of camp, we weren't supposed to, and hitchhike. And I remember Mary and I hitchhiking up to Lake Windermere once, and we'd stay in a bed and breakfast house overnight, had a boiled egg for breakfast, because you hadn't seen a boiled egg, you'd see a mug. And we walked the whole way on the length of Lake Windermere to Newby Bridge. It was 14 miles, I discovered, when I looked it up on the map. So we got in, it was getting late on the Sunday evening, on duty at 8 the next morning, you know, how are we going to get back? Unfortunately, a lorry came along and we hitched it. It was a whole way into Morecambe. I used to hitchhike during the war while I was in the services all over the place and never had anything unpleasant happen of any sort, did we? I mean, cars, lorries, sometimes you'd get on the lorry and one of you had to sit on the engine, which was rather hot, but in the middle, while the other one sat on the seat. And it didn't, even whether you were in uniform or whether you were in, you know, trousers and jerseys, as we got sent for. Another thing Mary discovered, she was always up to tricks, she found there was a little tailor in Morecambe that had quite a lot of officer's material that he wasn't being used, and no coupons in, and he agreed to make us a uniform for £7. It was quite a bit of money for us, we weren't paid a lot, but it was lovely to have a uniform made of real officer's material. And, you know, we wore that, of course, when we, later on, when we had to go out in the evenings and social things when we wore uniform. Anyway,
Mary and I decided we couldn't stand this sort of life. We had no idea how long the war would go on for. And we found out that when we were sent for to go to, back to Innsworth to do our corporal's training, we could remaster. And we thought what we wanted to do was to go into the operations room. So when we got to Innsworth, this was about 7 months after I'd been in Morecambe, we went to ask if we could do this, and they agreed. They said, you have to take an intelligence test first, which we did. I can't remember what numbers I got. And we had to sign the Official Secrets Act. And our job was called Clerk Special Duties. And it was, in fact, we were not supposed to tell people what we did or discuss it even with our families. And we didn't. We, you know, one just didn't. We felt you were trusted, and it was important trust to be given. Anyway, after a day of doing this sort of thing, we sent back to Morecambe to wait for our postings. And I realised we would be split up then, which indeed we were. She went off to somewhere else, and I was sent for to go to Digby, which was near Lincoln. And this was great excitement. It was slightly nearer my home in London. And Digby was a fighter station manned by Canadians. But the operations room was about 3 miles away from the camp, and it was a stately home, rather like a little miniature Buckingham Palace. And it belonged to the Countess of Lonsborough, whose husband had been killed earlier on, and she and Lady Zinnia, her daughter, lived in one end of the house, and the other end was for the Air Force. Their great hall, which was about the size of the Great Hall at Clevedon Court, was the operations room. You may have, I'm sure you've seen on the television in films what operations rooms have looked like. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big centre table and there's sort of galleries round with the controllers and various people looking down on the table. And the girls, the plotters, have a long rod with a magnet on the end, and there are these little figures with numbers on that are magnetised, and you move from square to square, as you hear over your headset, where this is to represent aircraft, these are where they've been moved to. I found I wasn't very good at it. I didn't like it. I almost panicked, and I thought, oh, whatever am I going to do? Because I was the only one who'd arrived, you see, everybody else had been in the job for ages. You know, I discovered there was a job that nobody wanted to do on the watch, and that was called Ops A. And as far as I remember, I was sat up somewhere near the controller with a headset on, and when there was a scramble for the fighters, there was a big blackboard with the numbers on of the fighters who were to be sent for, you know, immediately, and it would come over my headset, and I had to shout out, "Fighters 124, 125, scramble." And nobody wanted to do that, you see. Everybody was opening their mouth. I didn't mind in the slightest. So that's what I was bothered. Oh, they said, oh, Brooke, you'll do Opsay, won't you? And another thing I had to do was on that job was to ring up the dummy airfield. There's a little man we always felt had a little van, and he'd dash round and put the landing lights on. This was to distract the enemy and hope they would think that was a real airfield. The camp, as I said, was about 3 miles away. The village was about, I think, about 10 miles outside Lincoln. Lincoln, a lovely town, a lot of climbing about to do. But the first time there was a dance at the camp, they said the transport would arrive at 7 o'clock. So this big lorry drew up, and they dropped down the flat at the back, and the little steps was to clamber in. We all had to stand with nowhere to sit, you know, clinging to one another. We rushed up the lane to the the base, and I'll never forget it, when the flap of the lorry came down, there were all these gorgeous Canadian airmen all standing there. No need of little steps, I'm all ready to lift the sky. And I was fortunate, a charming young man came forward and lifted me down, and his name was Tom Westman. He'd been a schoolmaster in Canada, and he was in working in the offices there. And he became my sort of steady escort. You know, we had a little, what Julia and I used to call a little flingette, because he had a girlfriend in Canada and I had boyfriends, you know, dotted about in other parts of the flaring world. But it was lovely to have somebody to take you about. And you really had to be looked after there, because I remember even if on the camp, if you went to the ladies' ablutions,
your escort would come with you, wait outside, bring you back again, and Lincoln itself could be absolute chaos, because you see, as you remember, there were air stations all around, airfields all around Lincoln, it was so flat, a lot of the bomber stations, and when they were off duty, they would go mad, the pilots, you know. They didn't mean to be dangerous, but they could be, because they got so drunk sometimes. So it was just as well to have a nice tall young man to look after you. And what was so nice about living in this stately home was that I shared my bedroom with three other girls, and it was the children's nursery. And it had lovely frieze all around the side of the wall, and the bathroom, again, I can remember baths were a ration, of course, and that was one of those up a little flight of steps on a platform, you know, enclosed in a big mahogany, rigid all round. They had a mess and kitchens, huts all in the garden. It's a lovely garden you were allowed to sit in, nice old garden, you used to get fruit and that sort of thing, and there was a lovely park you could walk in. And really, it was a very pleasant and interesting existence. At one stage, I began to suffer rather from indigestion. And I went to see the MO, and he said, I think you may have a grumbling appendix. So I went to my father, and he said, oh, well, when you come on leave next month, he said, I'll ask for Dean of Bart, my old friend, if he can recommend some young surgeon. We village had it done by the Canadian Air Force, had it done in London. But anyway, when I went on leave, Dean of Bart, who by then was in his 70s, said, I'm coming out of retirement. He said, I can't suggest one of my young surgeons operates on Brooklyn Street, and I shall do it myself. Well, lucky old me, because he put me into the University College Hospital for 2 weeks, and I had weeks of sick leave, which the Canadian MOs could be never given you that when I saw him when I got back. And during that time, I re-met Rafe, who I met briefly before the war, and he was making a film, because he was with the Ministry of Information, and he worked for the Crown Film Unit. I don't think the film ever sort of reached the silver screen, but it was something to do with a whole lot of people in the ranks, from all different countries. And it was about 4 days filming, and I had a lovely time with sort of Canadians and Australians, New Zealanders, and Rafe, of course. So, you know, that was all rather nice, and sort of cemented a friendship which, as you know, gradually became a marriage in due course. But this present existence at Lincoln was not to continue, because I must have fallen out with one of the girls in my room for some reason, and she worked in the office. With the warrant officer. You see, you have to have an office to run the place, do all the work for the pay and the food ordering and all that sort of thing. And I was given, the worst thing that could happen to anybody was to be posted to group headquarters at Watnall. And one awesome day, I was woken up after night duty, after I had a night duty, and said, you're posted to Watnall tomorrow, pick up your pass, you'll go there. But that was, Watnall was not nice. It was just outside Nottingham. It was a little village called Kimberley. An enormous camp, a very big operation room, which was 80 feet below ground. They were awful watches. They were 8-hour solid watches, and the night watches, particularly from midnight to late in the morning, climbing up these flights of steps, after you'd finished a watch, was really, pretty awful.